The first, our first presentation today in this workshop on knowledge and legal standards of proof is by Edgar Aguilera from the University of Girona and BIAP. Edgar is a postdoc researcher now in the Barcelona Institute of Analytic Philosophy, and he's, in my view, one of the evidentialist scholars in the Spanish-speaking countries that we ought to study. Edgar, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Jordi, so much for that most kind presentation, and for all the organizers involved in the management of the organizing aspects of this Congress. Thank you so much as well. As you can see, I've changed the title of my talk, which now is Some Aspects of Proper Convictions. And given that that is the new title of my presentation, now I want to basically share with you the goal of the presentation and the basic, let's call them, components of the account I want to present to you here with. And then I'll spend some time in trying to, at least preliminarily, motivate a positive case regarding each of the components of such an account. So, moving forward, the main goal of my talk today is to present to you an account of proper convictions in the realm or in the domain of criminal law adjudication. And I should say some things about this theoretical account that I am trying to provide you with. It is a very, let's say, preliminary, sketchy, and also partial account. It is preliminary or sketchy in the sense that a lot of nuances and details need to be furtherly explored and explained. Lots of objections and critiques regarding each of the components of the account need to be addressed and need to be thought a little bit harder. And it is also an account that aspires to be continuous with what I take to be relevant epistemological discussions or positions. And this last feature of or characteristic of the account has to do with my deep conviction that general epistemology has something to offer to us scholars and lawyers trying to find out or to cash out the foundations or the epistemic foundations of our adjudicatory practices. That is why I have the intention for the account to be continuous with certain epistemological discussions. So now, as to the components the account is comprised of, let's go over them. I'm going to try to defend that criminal convictions require basically proper assertions to the effect that the defendant committed such and such acts or abstain from doing certain things, and to the effect that such behavior instantiates a class of criminal behavior as regarded as such by the relevant criminal law. I am going to try to focus on the first component of said assertion because I can anticipate that you might have trouble with accepting that an assertion that a behavior classifies under a certain legal heading may have its problems. But let's focus on the first part of the assertion that the defendant committed certain acts or abstained from doing certain things, which is the first component of the assertion. The second component of the account has to do or presupposes a so-called norm-based approach to give an account of proper assertions. And in that framework, I think that the governing norm of proper legal assertions is a norm that specifies or establishes a condition of epistemic safety. Very roughly put, I'm going to get into it a little bit more. The assertion, an assertion would be safe if the closest, if there is no closed world in which forming the belief that the accused is guilty exactly in the way that we form that belief in the actual world, that is taking into account the same evidence, would lead to a false conclusion. I'm going to try to spell out or spend some time trying to cash out this in I hope, more in clearer terms. But going back to this, so I think the governing norm of proper assertions within this context is the norm establishing a condition of epistemic safety. I think that the third component has to do with a particular interpretation of what has been called secondary propriety of assertions, which the way I interpret it is that the trier of fact, it has to be reasonable that the trier of fact considers, thinks, or believes that the condition, that is the safety condition, has been met. And not only that, he has or she has to basically explain or express the reasons why she thinks this has been the case. I'm going to try to go into the reasons why I think that within the legal domain, secondary propriety is at least more important than primary propriety. It is not the case. I am not claiming that primary propriety is not important, but in the case of the legal domain, I think an emphasis should be put on the secondary propriety of these proper legal assertions, factual assertions, findings of fact. And related to the third point, I think that we can make recourse to the fruitful recourse to the framework known as the relevant alternatives framework in order for the trier of fact to have an abstract argumentation scheme to argue in favor of stating that the safety condition has been met. I think that the way this theory is structured, its structural components may be used or interpreted as an abstract scheme that can guide the trier of fact to try to show why it is the case that the safety condition it has been met. And the last component of the account has to do with my claim that this all, the above, fits well with the law's worry that there be exacting and serious safeguards against wrongful convictions for false convictions. And I'm going to try to spend a little time defending a particular model or way to interpret those safeguards. And when I talk about safeguards against wrongful convictions, as any lawyer would know nowadays, I am referring to such doctrines, precepts, and concepts such as the presumption of innocence, the benefit of the doubt, the burden of proof on the shoulders of the prosecution, and having the necessity to have or to apply a very high or exacting standard of proof. So, as I said, I'm going to try to proceed by trying to show that there's a preliminary case supporting or in favor of each of the components of this account. So let's go with the part. Before that, sorry, I hope that you take is that in spite of you being agreeing or not with me in the way in which I argue in favor of proper assertions, I think that we should, the community of lawyers, but also maybe philosophers or anyone who wants to jump in the discussion, need to think seriously about legal assertions, right? Even if you don't agree with me in the way I characterize legal assertions, factual legal assertions, even if you don't agree with me that the best way to account for them is by making recourse to the norm-based approach and by selecting the condition of epistemic safety and whatever, the main takeaway is that we should think seriously about legal assertions, which to some extent are obvious in that even we have words to refer to such assertions, for instance, factual findings, or in a more civil law tradition, the determination of the facts of the case. And I think that the other point is that safety in criminal adjudication is a legitimate concern. Again, even if you don't agree with my portraying of this notion and the way in which I basically inserted in the arguments I want to give in favor of my account, I think that we should take some time, take seriously time to reflect upon safety in criminal adjudication. And moreover, if we consider that biased criminal investigations, that is, investigations carried out influenced by such biases as tunnel vision, premature closure, confirmation bias, prosecution complex, and the sort of biases, and even official misconduct, and all these phenomena, I think, is are becoming more common, at least if you take seriously the empirical research reported on such sources such as the National Registry of Exonerations. And in that sense, I think that thinking on safety, as we can think of about safety as a way to implement a devising technique known by cognitive psychologists and cognitive scientists in general, known as assuming the perspective of the devil's advocate, which has been, well, recorded to have some a good amount of efficiency in devising our beliefs and basically trying to counter the influence of these biases that I referred to before. And also, it is important because I think that more and more possible worlds that were unimaginable, but at least very far off in previous decades or previous times, are becoming more and more a reality. For instance, the use of artificial intelligence technology to create deep fakes. I mean, it's another possibility to explore when you think about, for instance, the reliability of evidence. So let's start very, very rapidly by asking, what are assertions? Well, basically, an assertion is the speech act by which we report, inform, tell others, state, or claim that such and such is the case. It's an act usually carried out by way of uttering a declarative sentence, and we would describe someone that we are looking at making an assertion as someone making a claim, making a statement, telling an audience that such and such is the case, reporting on a given state of affairs, expressing a judgment she has made, etc. There are, in the philosophical discussion trying to account for assertions, at least four approaches regarding assertions. One of those approaches is the so-called attitudinal approach, the other the common ground approach, the commitment approach, and the constitutive rule approach, going over very rapidly with each one of them. The attitudinal approach, for this approach, basically, to assert a proposition is to utter a sentence, a declarative sentence, with intention that it, the declarative sentence, be taken as a reason by the audience, both to think that I believe in the content of the proposition, in the content of the assertion, and that I have the intention for that audience to believe it as well. For the common ground approach, to assert is a proposal made by, for instance, the speaker, the one making the assertion, a proposal made to her hearer to alter the conversational score, that is an essential effect approach on speech acts in general, to alter the conversational score in terms of adding more information to the set of mutually accepted propositions by speaker and the hearer. Then we have the commitment approach, for which to assert that P is to undertake a commitment to the truth of P, and also entails, to a certain extent, the obligation or the duty to reveal the grounds that we have that entitle us to make an assertion. And last but not least, we have the constitutive rule approach, for which to assert is to make a move defined by its constitutive rule or its constitutive rules, that may take the following form: one must not perform speech acts of this type, that is, assertions, unless X, X is the basically the symbol. We can substitute X with the candidate condition, and that those conditions may be the following: unless P is true, unless one believes that P, unless it is rational in believing that P, unless one is justified in believing that P, unless one knows that P, and even unless one is certain that P. Notice that at least in this list, I don't include credences or partial beliefs. I think this is important because I think it is intuitive to state that if one has a partial belief, a credence, for instance, in this case that the accused is guilty of the crime charged with, you wouldn't dare to assert. You wouldn't, or if you dare, you wouldn't be making a proper assertion. And this is important also because I think that it is an avenue to explore and to see if that excludes the use of, for instance, the Bayesian model that works with credences and with a priori probabilities and a posteriori probabilities. I think that is something to take away from this. And well, I think that I will endorse the arguments provided by Sandy Goldberg in the sense that the constitutive rule approach seems to better explain an assertion's role in communication and the spread of knowledge, which Sandy Goldberg calls the epistemic significance of assertions. And the epistemic significance of assertions have to do with basically the speaker and the hearer are aware of the knowledge communicating use of the assertion and are prepared to treat them accordingly, which is called the communication of knowledge aptness of the assertions. The speaker wants her audience to accept the proposition presented as true, and there is a good chance for this to happen because in proper assertion, most times the audience credits the speaker with credibility or reliability. This is called belief worthiness. And also another aspect of this is that assertions susceptibility to epistemic change. And the last feature of the epistemic significance of assertions has to do with the speaker represents herself as knowing what she asserts, or at least as having evidence for the claim. All these sub-features, let's call them like that, are included in the general heading of assertions epistemic significance. And the point, Sandy Goldberg's point, is that the constitutive rule approach is better or performs better in terms of accounting for the epistemic significance of assertions. So I'm going to assume that. Now we come to the following point. Why do we need assertions in the legal domain? I'm going to here to put forward in a nutshell or in a very synthetic way some of the arguments advanced by, for instance, Liat Levinson and Lewis Ross to the effect that we need assertions in the legal domain. These arguments are very intuitive or trying to support a very intuitive point. For Liat Levinson, basically, the main reason that we want or that there is a need in the legal domain to have legal assertions when a conviction is in order is that respect owed to the victim. And the prosecutor requires precisely that, requires that wrongdoing to be publicly reported, that is publicly asserted, publicly condemned, and publicly attributed to the perpetrator, so society as a whole may blame her, that is the perpetrator, and proceed by imposing to her the respective punishment. So, of course, Liat Levinson's account is more sophisticated than this nutshell argument version of the argument I'm giving, but think of the need for assertions as a requirement of the value of respect that becomes relevant in adjudication. Also, respect for both parties to a dispute, and in the case of criminal adjudication, respect to the victim and to the perpetrator. And this assertion has to basically be based on, according to Liat Levinson, the best effort to eliminate the risk of error. So basically, she thinks that wrongful behavior, wrongdoing, either morally or legally, poses or gives rise to two challenges, which she calls the practical challenge and the epistemic challenge. Basically, when someone is subject or target of wrongdoing, the one perpetrating the bad or the erroneous or the wrongful behavior didn't treat her as an entity worthy of respect, as an entity herself, or whatever. And what we want to do as Priors of Fact is to basically kind of restate the fact that the victim really is someone worthy of respect in the sense of not being harmed. And that is why, and also because nowadays it is said that victims have the right to know the truth. This happens, for instance, in the realm of genocide and crimes against humanity, where basically very slowly, but there's a case law that states that this right exists, but I think morally it exists, because sometimes, depending on the sophistication of the crime committed, not even the victim knows what happens to her, and it requires, or it takes a very serious and thorough investigation in order to basically bring to the surface the intricate, for instance, connections between different actors, because recall this right to know the truth basically emerged in the context of enforced disappearances or such kind of heinous crimes. So the victim has a right to know the truth, either a moral or legal right. That is also one of the reasons that we need to report publicly, so she can also learn what happened, and also society as a whole, when experiencing these kinds of atrocities, but not only that. And also we have to respect the perpetrator, and we do that by way of conducting a thorough investigation that manifests our best effort to eliminate the risk of error. Here there is a glimpse already in the work of Lebanon to the safety condition. And in the case of Louis Ross, he basically views positive verdicts and the assertions contained in those verdicts, that is, the factual findings in those verdicts, as a way to discharge the synthetic function and the indicative representation we delegate to the triers of fact. And in that sense, for Louis Ross, the positive verdicts and the assertions contained in it basically send a signal that we would have come to the same conclusion that the accused is guilty based on an inquiry as thorough and complete as the one we ourselves would have carried out, which has been carried out, at least that is the presupposition, by the specific prior fact trying the case at hand. So I think the important notions of these arguments or these ideas in this case are synthetic function that we delegate, a synthetic function, basically we want them to inquire whether or not the evidence that the prosecution managed to gather or to collect against the defendant is of the has the strength that we legitimately expect it has, and the important function that basically the verdict signals to the people and to the audience, to whomever that may read the verdict, that a thorough investigation and complete investigation has been carried out. Okay, so much for the very preliminary case that we need assertions in the legal domain and specifically when a criminal conviction is in order. So now we've come to the point where we can ask what is safety, and safety basically, the way I interpret it here is an assertion is safe. I link safety to the assertion. In the general epistemological literature, safety is linked to beliefs. But I think that you can make this transpolation. And not only I do this, but also other authors such as Michael Pardo in the realm of legal epistemology. So we can say that an assertion is safe if the content, the proposition expressed by the sentence, the declarative sentence that an assertion consists of, is safe if it could have not easily been false, which is to say that it is safe if it is difficult that one be mistaken in thinking the defendant is guilty, or is safe if there is a low risk that despite the available criminal evidence, the defendant be innocent, or in more technical terms, if there are no close possible worlds in which using the same evidence as in the actual world leads to drawing a false conclusion. Very roughly, that is what I take safety to be, or to interpret in my account. And I joined Duncan Pritchard in the realm of general epistemology, and as I said before, Michael Pario in the realm of legal epistemology, in thinking that the epistemic safety condition, or the epistemic safety rule, constitutive rule of assertions, performs better, for instance, than a knowledge or justified belief condition for proper assertions. And this, I think, you can see more clearly in cases that have come to be known as cases of selfless assertions. For instance, Jennifer Lackey has presented us with two examples. So one has to do with a creationist teacher, and the other has to do with a prior of fact. Let's call him Raymond, racist Raymond. So in the first of the cases, what happens in these cases? I'm going to anticipate this so we can be in the same channel. What happens in these cases is that the subjects of the examples don't even believe in the proposition that we would be inclined, or our intuition would tell us that it is proper to assert. For instance, in the case of the creationist teacher, she is able to recognize or to acknowledge that there is ample scientific evidence supporting the theory of evolution. Nonetheless, for non-epistemic reasons, she cannot accept or cannot believe that that evolutionary theory is true. So for non-epistemic reasons, she doesn't even have the belief. And if she doesn't even believe, much less knows that the theory of evolution is true, and therefore you couldn't, in those cases, given that they don't even believe, you would have to conclude that an assertion is not proper there. But our intuitions, at least Lackey's intuitions, tell her that it would be proper in a certain sense to that the creationist teacher asserts that that evolutionary theory is true or is the case. The case of racist Raymond is a case of a trier of fact. Let's think of him as a judge performing the role of trier of fact, who is a racist, but in the process of rehabilitating himself, he has taken courses, he now can understand the way in which, or the intrinsic psychological mechanisms involved in the effects of racism, etc. And so he has come to a point where he can, for instance, acknowledge, as in the case of the creationist teacher, that the evidence, for instance, in the case he is now trying, points to the defendant's guilt in a way that makes him reasonably think, that the applicable standard of proof has been met. But nonetheless, he, due to kind of a remnant effect of his racism, realizes that he cannot believe that the accused is guilty. So these two cases, I think, Lackey thinks also, and Pritchard also, that pose a problem to the models specifying that the condition for proper assertions are either justified belief or knowledge, because in neither of those cases you don't even have even the belief. So if that condition is not met, you cannot say that you can issue a proper assertion there, and so you have that. But that this doesn't happen with the, at least it is argued, doesn't happen with a safety condition, because that property is not attached to the beliefs nor to the knowing states of the agents, but to certain features or characteristics of the evidence, basically the capacity or aptness of the evidence to exclude relevant alternative possibilities, close possibilities in which you would have the same evidence, but nonetheless the defendant would be innocent as well. Now, for the component of the account that has to do with secondary propriety, I interpret secondary propriety, as I said before, as the need or the obligation, the duty of the prior fact of explaining why it is reasonable to think that the condition, in this case the safety condition, which I am endorsing or proposing, has been met. I think this is of particular importance in the legal domain, mainly because of the duty to issue recent judgments or recent verdicts, which is, I think, more established in the civil law tradition. But nonetheless, I think more and more there's a movement in also the common law tradition to basically want verdicts to be also reasoned in the sense of producing a document explicitly the reasons supporting the conviction. So from this point, I think also that, as I said, the so-called relative alternatives framework can provide the prior fact with an abstract argumentation scheme in order for her to show precisely that it is reasonable to think that the proposition contained in the assertion is safe. So according to my interpretation of the relevant alternatives framework, an assertion is secondarily proper, at least secondarily proper if the prior fact reasonably determines that all the relevant error possibilities, that is, innocent scenarios consistent with the same evidence, have been ruled out. Of course, we would have to spend much time developing each of the components of these structural features of the relevant alternatives model. We should have to spend some time in explaining which or what determines which possibilities are relevant and what determines or what the operation of discarding or ruling out scenarios in which the accused is innocent to be ruled out or discarded, what does that consist of? Okay. Georgi Gallwiner thinks that the relative alternatives framework can be interpreted as a severe test that combines two notions that are very important in epistemology, also the sensitivity and the safety condition, which are in, I wouldn't say most cases, but sometimes are interpreted as related, but kind of different conditions and maybe opposing conditions. And the way in which she argues that this combination could be brought about is by way of the following kind of procedure. You would, in order for following these abstract schemata, or abstract scheme, you would have to think of all the possible innocent scenarios consistent with the main components of the body of evidence that you are confronted with. That would be evidence in sensitive scenarios in which the evidence wouldn't change and still, and despite of that, the accused would be innocent. That is, those are cases of insensitive evidence because it wouldn't change even if the target proposition were false, and then determine whether they are relevant or reasonable, at least nor far off, extravagant or far-fetched, and whether the evidence addresses them and rules them out. Now, I think this all fits well with what I said at the beginning, with Law's worry that there be exacting safeguards against wrongful conviction. This is a worry underlying certain doctrines, as I said, the benefit of the doubt, the presumption of innocence, the burden of the proof, the burden of proof on the shoulders of the prosecution, and finally, the need that a high standard of proof be applicable and implemented, such as beyond all reasonable doubt. And it also fits well, I think, with legal notions such as evidence reliability, because to a certain extent, evidence reliability has to do with how many of these alternative scenarios in which the evidence wouldn't be reliable. For instance, a witness may be lying. For instance, a witness may have incurred in an honest mistake because of the observational conditions where the perceptual activity took place. So you would need corroborating evidence in order to rule out those possible scenarios in which the evidence wouldn't be reliable or as reliable as we would expect it to be. And, I'm going to leave for the discussion the specifics of the kind of interpretation or model that I think is more suitable to these notions, because you see, there is in legal philosophy and criminal law discussions about what is the model that best justifies the structure of proof within criminal procedures. There's, you have the model that states that what justifies having the proof structure that we have in criminal procedures is because we want that structure to contribute to errors being distributed in a certain way, in a way that reflects basically the most expected utilities you can get out of convicting the defendant, for which you have to consider or to factor in the consequences or the costs or the disutilities of false acquittals and false convictions, but also the utilities or the benefits or the advantages of the good outcomes in which in this case would be true convictions and true acquittals. I think there's an alternative to think about this. Some of them, I think this will come out in the discussion, I think Jordi, for instance, think that this application of the expected utility theory basically kind of reveals our commitment to objectivity in the moral domain. Maybe I am too fast reconstructing his position, but I would disagree. And I think there is a better model out there to justify differently why do we have the proof structure that we have. It is model worried, whose the main worry of which is not to strike a balance of expected utility, but to impose legitimately or justifiably the punishment upon the defendant. And if that is the case, it follows a certain type of interpretation of such notions that I had addressed, that I previously recounted. And, well, for my part, that's it, and I'm looking forward for your feedback. Thank you very much.
Okay, it's open. Williamson.
Yeah, so this is about your discussion of safety. So it seems to me that the way you presented it involved some kind of a mixture of characterization, I mean, of two different notions of safety, and one of which I would think of as the natural notion of safety, and the other of which I'd think of as Pritchard's kind of ad hoc variations or kind of fiddlings about with the natural notion. And, you know, and he came out with on the one hand, you were talking about it as, you know, given the evidence, there are no close possible worlds where there's error. And the other with when you talk about a low risk of error. And those are not really compatible characterizations of safety, because I mean the natural notion of it has two structural features that are very important to its operation. I mean, one is that it's factive, in the sense that if something is safe from error, then it's true. Mm-hmm. And the other is that it's closed under conjunction, so that if you have a number of safe assertions, in this case, then asserting their conjunction will also be safe. And those both seem very, very natural in, you know, that because you know, if something happens in the actual world, then it's you're not safe from it not happening. And also, you know, if there are various sources of error and you're safe from each source, then you're safe from any error from any of those sources. But if you take the low risk model, mm-hmm. That doesn't have either of those structural features. I mean, something, you know, if something by an extraordinary coincidence happens in the actual world, then it's still, you know, low risk relative to the mm-hmm. Evidence. But it did happen, and also, you know, if you have a conjunction P and Q where there's a low risk of not P and a low risk of not queue. It can still be that there's a not low risk of not P or not Q. And, you know, and so it seems, and I thought that in the legal context, the kind of natural structural features are the ones that you want, because the idea that, you know, a conviction should be safe but incorrect seems a bit off. And also, you know, if what you're doing is, you know, considering some kind of, you know, case that it is for one side or the other. I mean, you want to test it, to apply the test. I mean, or you would apply the test to this overall, you know, maybe quite complex case by applying it to each element of the case, and that's essentially. You know, if you're thinking that applying it to each element and getting a positive answer means that the whole thing will be safe, that's using the closure and the convention rule. So that it seems to me that there are very natural attractions in the natural notion of safety, which. You know, which messing with it in the way that Pritchard does is basically throwing away the very structural features that you want.
Thank you, Professor. That's wonderful. Not all the fault has to do with Pritchard. I've also kind of twisted with the original notion, but now you're making me aware of the consequences that this has. Just to say that I think Pritchard also would say that the safety condition is a factive condition, because we would define it as a cognitive success that couldn't have been cognitive failure. So he is assuming that in the first place we have cognitive success, that it is true and that it is factive. But elsewhere in the development of his argument, he kind of loses the the hold to the factivity of the condition.
Yeah, I mean, he throws it away in the general account because it's a kind of few close possible worlds rather than a no close possible worlds account, and then he adds it back in just in a completely ad hoc way. Whereas the one attraction of the original account is that it's just a natural outcome of this model of safety that, you know, because. Just if you just think about safety in a kind of natural way, it's, you know, if you succumb to a danger, it follows from that that you are not safe from that danger. That's the natural way of thinking about safety, and you don't need to make any kind of ad hoc moves in order to get safety. It's just built into the model, but simply because the actual world is as close as. As possible closest to itself.
And do you think a clause basically stating that we can assuming that the proposition is true, what would happen if, so the assumption of the truth of the proposition, even if because in real world examples that is what the legal operator doesn't know, which is that the proposition is true.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not. I mean, the question that you're trying to decide is whether a certain proposition is true, and you're trying to get to a safe. Well, at least if it's a conviction, you want the conviction to be safe. And so you know the idea is to build a body of evidence such that there's no close possible world in which all that evidence holds, but the defendant is innocent, and I think that seems like it's a kind of somewhat schematic model, because you know obviously the notion of close here isn't precise, you know, but I mean, of course, that applies both to the original version of Satie and to the Pritchard variation on it. So, you know, you can't do everything just with the schematic model, but it seems like it's quite a helpful, you know, overall schema within which one then can then make all sorts of, you know, more specific moves, which kind of, in a way, you're trying, you know, filling in the notion of closeness.
That's great. Thank you.
Okay.
Juan.
Number of questions. Let me just ask you, were you thinking that what you were saying here applies to civil cases too?
Okay. Do you want an answer right now? Yes. Well, nothing. yes, first, Gardiner thinks that it applies also to civil litigation, because she has this framework, this machinery in which, going back to what Professor Williamson was saying, a hard thing is how to define closeness or the distance of the error possibilities that we're considering. And I think that the classical way in which this condition, this feature is spelled out is by way of closeness or being distant from the actual world has to do with how much the actual world would have to change if the target proposition were false in another world. So in the case of the lottery example that you yourself, Juan, were talking about yesterday, in the world that we live in, it happens that even though the odds against me having a winning lottery ticket are maybe huge, nonetheless, a minor change, a different configuration of the numbers or the balls, which is not a huge or substantial change in the actual world, would lead us astray, or would lead us why did I say that? Because moving away from that notion, or wanting to keep track to it, but in a very particular way, Gardiner states that you can have these concentric circles closeness and remoteness. For instance, in the case of civil litigation, the so-called preponderance of the evidence is supposed to capture the most ordinary or preponderant possibilities of error. Of course, this is very vaguely stated, and we would have to fill in the blanks and make a more detailed development of this. But the idea is that in the civil cases, you have this belt of ordinary error possibilities. For instance, that the evidence that the witness is lying, or that the witness made an honest mistake. But as soon as you move from your classic or central case of civil litigation, where not so much is at stake, etc., then you have to consider more distant error possibilities. And when you get to the criminal law, you have to consider the most remote possibilities that you wouldn't consider if you were in a civil litigation case. So it's kind of an accumulating model in which these concentric circles are superimposed. And and you can use the same framework, but variating the disregardability of certain error possibilities in order to adjust the model to the different standards of proof. And you can do that also with the civil litigation case.
Yeah, but I was so the assertion in the civil case is the same as in a criminal case. The assertion is the defendant is guilty, right?
Yes, well, I would say that the assertion is not guilty, liable. And if you don't want to commit
liable,
or basically you did such and such things, let's stick to that.
Is the one that you think has to be saved.
Yeah.
But not as much. Not as safe.
Not as safe. Yes.
Yeah, I worry that you get into the issues. That safety framework begins to crumble a little bit when you're trying to accommodate. Oh, this one's closer than that one, but it lends itself to ad hoc maneuvering just to pick whatever you want to say to the case. But I understand the rough idea that you're working.
Just one thing, sorry. It could be the same session.
Yeah. I take it that it is the same.
Due to the commission of crime. So it's the same assertion.
Yeah, and then if it's the same assertion, then you're just applying stricter safety standards in the criminal case, and I worry a little bit about that.
But you don't think that standards of proof, for instance, should be sensitive to what is at stake?
I am deeply puzzled by the standard of proof in a civil case, in general.
Okay. Okay. Because the.
Well, I'm so low that I don't understand what the hell.
And there may be also a gap between the official interpretation or wording of the so-called standard and the way it is practiced. Do you have an idea? Ideal standard, or you don't think that the notion of a standard of proof is robust enough, or in the civil litigation case you don't think you can speak of standards, or what is your...
I think it should be the same in the civil case and in a criminal case. Put it in terms that are not my official position, closer to things, because you should know that they did it. Both cases.
Yeah, you see, for instance, I think Sarah Moss and also Liat Levinson think that you can have that, but in the case of civil litigation, you can have not probabilistic knowledge. You can have knowledge that it is more likely than not that.
Yeah, I don't like that. You know that.
Okay. Yeah. Also, the intuition that knowledge can be good enough in certain domains in terms of the evidentiary basis for that knowledge. But the evidentiary basis of knowing that in another domain may not be ideal or
don't
sufficient.
Like that either.
Okay. Well,
you should know in the same sense in both cases.
Yep. Okay. So.
But that goes well beyond whatever you said. Well, maybe not. Maybe. So it goes to what the assertion is and what the standard of the assertion is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your illuminating presentation. I have a bit orthogonal question, but perhaps indirectly related to that. The center of your presentation is convictions and safety and beliefs and beliefs and truth and so on, but in some cases, you know, and Jordi contributed to this point in a crucial way, judges. The requirement of judges is not belief. It's not belief. It's something like acceptance. Mm. Not believing something like acceptance. One case for example, my point. One case in the 18th century when Minorca, the island of Minorca in Balearic Islands, was part of a British empire of the British domain. There was a case, Mostyn Bulfabigas. Mostyn was the governor of Minorca, the English governor of Minorca, and arrested Fabigas unjustly, it seems, unjustly, arrested for bond and so on. At the end, Fabigas, impossible to Fabigas to sue Mostyn, the governor in Minorca, because to make that was necessary the authorization of the governor. That's not possible. Not possible. Went to London. And a court in London convicted Mostyn for this unjust arrest and so on. And the governor must make an appellation with the argument, not with the argument of the substantive aspect of the arrest, but for the jurisdiction, saying that this court in London had no jurisdiction on a case happening in Minorca. And the court in appellation, Lord Mansfield, a very important jurist in England at the time, decided that Minorca is part of London. in the district of Marylebone, he said, Minorca is part of London. When we should manage this aspect of law, because this aspect is fictions in law. Fictions in law are normal. This is a very exaggerated case and very critical case for other reasons, but there are a lot of fictions, and fictions are something Longfellow Fuller said. Fictions are falsities taken as truth. That's true in law. Well, what's acceptance? What's this case? What's the requirements of this kind of convictions? Because about that is necessary also to put as premise in the legal reasoning, the judicial reasoning, and well, that's. I'm not sure what's the answer. But.
No. Thank you, José Juan, for that. For that thought, and I think that I was previously detaching, or it came a point in my thinking that I wanted myself to be detached from the idea of there being a difference between belief and acceptance. I wanted to join, for instance, Hack's arguments that the notion, the distinction is not kind of a but now I find myself more sympathetic to the acceptance case, and because if you understand acceptance as the disposition to and carrying out that disposition of using or premising a certain premise or proposition in your reasoning, leading you to a certain conclusion without having the commitment to believing in the content of what you accept, in that part, I think there are similarities between those who propose the acceptance model and my model. But I think that at least but Jordi says that acceptance may be subjected to different standards of proof as well, okay, and I think that's the case, but the point I see is that the way in which I want to cash out the terms in which I want to cash out the specifications of each of the standards. So we come to an agreement, I think, that acceptance kind of does the job because it doesn't commit you with believing, but you have another component of the picture that I think is missing, at least in the way standards would have to be cashed out.
To that, in this debate about, for instance, common ground in pragmatics and so on, mm-hmm. sometimes is defended that in the common ground there are sometimes false propositions, and that's important.
Okay.
And that's, we should manage these false propositions in the common ground.
Oh, that's helpful. Oh. Thank you.
Okay, André.
Yep.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for the talk. It was very interesting. It's related to Williamson's question. As you know, there are much of the debate about safety is how exactly to formulate it. Mm-hmm. And you have that low risk at some point, but I interpreted you as taking the no-close worlds conception of safety. Anyway, I'll assume this for my question at least.
Okay.
And other people would allow that make you like reject maybe for some close beliefs, or you get it wrong in some close ones, a few close ones, mm-hmm. That this conception has its own problems, as Professor Williamson showed. But I wanted to focus on this no close world conception of safety, and some people have argued that it has an alleged problem with inductive knowledge. In cases of inductive knowledge, there would always be at least a few close worlds in which you get it wrong. And I'm not saying that I agree with this objection, but I wanted to ask, because I know nothing about legal matters, mm-hmm. if you think that in the legal domain, the evidence, the support that the evidence gives to the conviction can be, at least in some cases, inductive. And if so, mm-hmm. this alleged problem of this no closed world conception of safety with inductive knowledge would also arise. Mm-hmm. In the legal domain, and then how, I don't know, if you have any thoughts how you would solve this alleged problem.
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. Well, to the first point of your question, I would say, well, there are people who want to characterize legal reasoning or reasoning with evidence basically as inductive reasoning in a very general sense, basically ampliative reasoning, which some take it to be as basically collecting or registering observations and and using them to support a certain conclusion that is not conclusively true, not deductively true. So also, for instance, Cohen, when he argued for this acceptance notion, he basically was thinking in the legal case, in the way a jury treats the evidence, which is different to probability. He wanted to talk about a more Baconian type of probability. And so I think that we can agree that evidentiary reasoning in the legal domain has an inductive aspect. Some would characterize this as abductive even. At least one phase or one aspect of evidential reasoning, which is closest to what the investigators do in the beginning of the process when they are trying to come up or to concoct these different scenarios or hypotheses, lines of investigation that they would have to follow up, because precisely they encounter themselves with anomalous facts or unexpected facts. Those facts being the traces or the things that you find in the criminal in the crime scene. So, and then you have to work with certain hypotheses of what happened. So that is why some authors are more sympathetic to explaining or to accounting for those initial phases of the proceedings as abductive reasoning being carried out. So there's a debate regarding how best characterize legal evidential reasoning, but I don't think that you have to view the positions as necessarily opposing. Maybe you can adopt an emphasis approach in basically having to do with the different procedures in which the legal operator, for instance, in this case the investigator, is trying to reason about the evidence. So there's a lot of work, I think, to be done in terms of how to come up with a harmonic model of the different phases of evidential reasoning, and how to, well, but conceding that you might think of evidential reasoning as inductive reasoning, and then we must face the difficulty that you were stressing, I would say that, yeah, I think that's one, in my reading, that's one of the critics why in epistemology sensitivity is not argued for fully as a condition of knowledge. Because if you... What do I mean by this? Because you can think of insensitive evidence scenarios basically depending on your creativity, I think you. I would say that it is not very hard, or even if it is hard, you can come up with a scenario where you would look at the same evidence, despite the fact that the defendant is innocent. Some of them are going to be far-fetched. Some of them are going to be far off. Some are going to be outrageous. But still, you could characterize those scenarios as scenarios in which the assertion would be insensitive, and more specifically, the evidence wouldn't track the changes in the world, because we are assuming that we are trying to come up with scenarios where you have the same evidence, or where you have a hypothesis that allows you to predict the same evidence is going to be gathered, or that allows you to have the same expectation that the same evidence is going to be collected. You can come up with evil demon hypotheses, or that the universe was created just 5 minutes ago. So that, I think that that's a problem. But the way I understand safety, it kind of puts a limit to that with the clause of speaking of closest possible worlds, and trying to spell out that closeness or distance with the idea of how much does the actual world would have to change if that world were true. Yeah, but thank you for this. It's something I need to reflect upon more fully.
Yeah. Sensitivity for sure has problems with inductive knowledge, I would agree. With safety, the idea, you know, let's say my belief that my car is still parked out there is based on induction, let's say. I could make a case that the world where my car is actually not there, because I don't know, someone stole it, maybe it's not that far away. Maybe you would say, okay, but if it's close, then you really don't know that your car is still there. You can play with this. I think Richard would say, it's close, but it's not from the closest, the very close ones. That's his solution, but it's a little ad hoc, as Professor said. I don't know, yeah. I actually don't have a solution.
Yeah. Maybe. No, you have to give me food for thought. Thank you.
Okay, Carla.
So, there are formational safety that, you know, people also handle industrial knowledge. So that typically they think of closeness in terms of normality metric, and it's about looking at the as close as those kind of versions would handle inductive knowledge cases. And they are actually proposed for example. So, yeah.
Okay.
But it's your time for your question.
So I wanted to ask about, two things. So one is, so you have safety as a normal assertion, but then you have the relevant alternative framework for inquiry. And I was a bit puzzled by that, because, at least the standard formulation of each, like one will vindicate simple premise closure, the other won't. And so there will be cases where you can assert properly the P, and you can assert properly Q, where P goes Q. When you allow for the premise to P, but you cannot allow for the premise to Q. And that sounds like a crash in your framework. So I'm not sure you can combine them.
Yeah,
that's FAR, you know.
But in a very structural kind of sketchy way, in terms of basically thinking how.
Yeah, they don't mesh very well together, unless you say something.
Yeah, unless you say
something. And the other thing is, I was curious that you think of the jury's verdict as assertions. They do definitely have the direction of fit, but they also have the other one, direction of fit, that, you know, like they kind of rule things. They have ruling effects.
Ruling
effects. Yeah. Okay. And so I wonder if you want a bit more, the picture of the speech should be a bit more more sophisticated. Should have both direction of fit, and so the constitutive norm should perhaps involve the assertion one, but also say something about the kind of variable aspect.
Okay, so...
I mean, it's not just an assertion, I think.
So that's
also a ruling effect.
Yes, that's...
Yeah.
And so,
you know, just it is... I mean, definitely, you know, the second dimension may be the assertion dimension, but, you know...
No, so...
It's a bit too big to say this, those are just assertion. I would say that kind of... something like really can double, like, directional feet kind of switch ups.
Okay.
Could I just... A finger on that... So, also, with the juries, in the jury's case, it's what's called a forced choice assertion. I mean, the jury, is supposed to bring in a verdict.
Yes,
and,
yes.
You know, and when you have a forced choice assertion, it's not, I mean, that's not a full assertion. I mean, you know, so if you see somebody in the, in the distance, and, you know, is that your mother? Yes or no? They're forced to give an answer.
Yeah.
But because of the fact that they're forced to do it, you don't apply the standard of knowledge to them, and you don't treat it as an assertion that they would come up with, you know, as it were, if they weren't under duress. I mean, of course, with the jury, it's more complicated because there are these issues of burden of proof and so on. But but I think it's still not a normal, as it were, just a free assertion that the jury is making. And so I think that you know, to some extent, modifies what Speech Act the jury are performing. Even on, I mean, you know, of course, Carlos is right, absolutely right that it's a. I mean, I think, you know, it's a verdictive and it has also, you know, sorts of repercussions. But the mere fact that it's a forced choice also
forced choice.
Modifies.
Now that's very interesting, and that's why I mean, we have this model, false choice model, because it's a way in which we have. We think we have come up with a way to ensure that if errors are going to be committed, if and when errors in the sense of verdicts that do not correspond with reality are going to be committed, we'd rather that those errors be false acquittals. And so everything, if the standard of proof, this is why the standard of proof, at least according to the official doctrine, we want it to be very high, because we want it to have the effect of making, hopefully, false acquittals more abundant in the long run than false convictions. But in previous and in periods of history, and to my knowledge in some parts of the world nowadays, there are models in which the jury has more than two options and more than one standard. And my question would be to you, just very roughly, would you think that would pose a more proper assertion environment where you have different standards of proof and different choices on what you can assert, if that is the case?
Yeah, I mean, in Scotland there's a case of
for instance.
Proven. Yeah, although it's a rather unclear situation at that. But I don't think that for the resources. I mean, I take your point that in a way, the asymmetry between, you know, not guilty and not guilty verdicts and their relation to proof, you know, it is in a way designed to bring it back to. To something closer to the, as it were, the natural case of just making an assertion, but it's kind of, but it's still, you know, it's still not a, it's definitely not a normal, it's not a kind of just a regular case of assertion, because you're it's a kind of forced choice thing, and then you're kind of artificially trying to within the forced choice setting, you're trying to, as it were, simulate. Roughly speaking, a regular assertion, and you know, but I mean, I think some kind of story needs to be told about how, you know, whether you really got back to the normal case.
Okay.
And for sure, you know, we would judge if that let's say that the head of the chair of the jury, that, you know, that if he then goes off to the pub and starts talking about the case, we're not going to judge his assertion and about whether the defendant was
that's right
guilty. I mean, you know, in the same way,
in the same way when he performed the official role. Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. No, just I was just basically going back to Juan Comesaña's comment that much of the viability of this and other model of assertion depends on the content or the target proposition. I was thinking that if things would change if the target proposition were not that the defendant is guilty or not that the defendant committed such and such acts, but the assertion more specifically regarded or related to evidence, that the assertion that this evidence meets the standard of proof, for instance, or this evidence supports this other proposition to a particular degree, which makes it itself, I think, an assertion within a general assertion. I don't know, but...
Finger question by Juan.
Yeah, just very quickly on this exchange. So the asymmetry, I think it's... So it's clearly true, I think, that the acquittals are not subject to the same ordinary assertion. I think the intention is that convictions are even stronger than in the case. Not that they're weaker. Uh-huh. So that the, you know, all the same norms as ordinary assertions should apply for convictions and more.
And more.
But for acquittals, uh-huh, less.
Yeah, because the effect that standard of proof creates is that you have, well, I'm going to describe it like this. You have no guarantee that when somebody is acquitted, her innocence has been proven.
Right.
That is why we are, the jury or the trier of fact is only committed to state that the relevant standard of proof applicable for convictions has not been met. And that is why, or that explains the issuing of an acquittal. But not necessarily that the person is innocent. And in that case, do you think, so just to take advantage of your opinion here, do you think that there is, in the case of acquittals, an assertion that could be analyzed, or something that could be analyzed in assertorical terms?
I mean, I don't know what the actual official assertion is supposed to be, mm-hmm, in the part of the not guilty or whatever. I think that's not subject to the ordinary norms of assertion, whatever they are.
Okay.
It should be the case, I don't know whether it is, but it should be the case that if the finder of fact convicts, then if you do ask him in the pub, he should be able to say, oh yeah, totally did. Whereas the for acquittals, that doesn't apply.
But the innocence could be affirmed as proven.
Yeah. I mean, it's compatible, but not necessarily.
In this case, there is an assertion about the innocence.
Yeah, you're right. So when the strategy of the defense implies that she's going to try to go on proof to a certain standard the innocence of his client or her client, in those cases, maybe you have a similar situation where something is asserted, and in those cases you could say that acquittal or the acquittal involves, now I am doubting if asserting or not, but stating that the accused is innocent, materially innocent.
But would that actually be in the content? Because I mean, if supposing it's a case where the defense, mm-hmm, attempts to prove the innocence of the accused, mm-hmm, but in the jury's opinion the defense has not succeeded in proving the innocence but has succeeded in, you know, casting sufficient doubt, mm-hmm, then they're still supposed to have come up with a non-guilty verdict, and so the meaning of the non-guilty verdict, even where the defence was trying to prove innocence, isn't that innocence has been proved. It's simply that the guilt has not been approved. So, but I mean, one way you can try to understand it would be that although it's conventionally put as a finding of guilty or not guilty, mm-hmm. The understood content is something like, in the case of a guilty verdict, was that the case for guilt has been beyond reasonable doubt, and in the case of a not guilty verdict, it's that the case is not beyond reasonable doubt, and then if you put them that way, they're. It's easier to understand the not guilty verdict as an assertion that just that the case is not beyond reasonable doubt, mm-hmm. but it still is it's still kind of forced choice situation because the jury might simply be. They might simply not know whether the case is beyond reasonable doubt or not, be kind of confused, and then decide, well, if it's as messy as this, we better go for not guilty, and that and that seems like, but the going for not guilty is a product of the fact that they don't want to be a hung jury.
And because we have the legal fiction going back to what was discussed yesterday, that every case in which, for instance, your case, I'm not sure if I know that these facts have been established beyond a reasonable doubt, would have to be resolved in favor of the accused because we have this policy called the benefit of the doubt, of the reasonable doubt. So it kind of encompasses those cases in which the jury experiences doubt regarding whether they know or not know that Bard has been satisfied. Yeah. Of course, this is a legal fiction, but has political roots, and we want to protect more the innocent defendant. Yeah.
Papagiannis, Diego Papagiannis.
Thank you. I'm just wondering whether O'Hara or framework combines the epistemological concern with some conception of the standard of proof as purely political. Mm. Because at the beginning of your presentation, it seems that you assign to higher standard of proof an epistemic function. Mm-hmm. It works in order to. It contributes to the safety of the assertion. Mm. But at the end of the presentation, you talked about distribution of error, and then you have to take into account the disability of wrongful acquittals and wrongful convictions, on the one hand, and the utility of right convictions and acquittals. But this seems to aim at different directions. Mm. I mean, if you are concerned with the epistemological, then you should know. Mm-hmm. So there is only one standard of proof. There is nothing to distribute. I'm sorry about the consequences, but you should know. Well, maybe you think that knowing is never possible, so we are talking about decisions under uncertainty. But in that framework, now the problem I think is even worse because you have to take into account the utility of false convictions. It's contingent that that convicting someone innocent would not bring about good results. Maybe it's the right thing to do in social terms, convicting some people that are innocent, because that would be the best to deter certain kind of acts. And the same, maybe there is bad consequences. There are bad consequences in convicting correctly the offenders. For example, if most people think that they're being convicted because they are black, for example, but they're really guilty, maybe you shouldn't convict them because of the social consequences. I think there is a very strong tension between the epistemological view at the beginning of your talk and the consequentialist political aspect of the standard proof at the end.
Yeah. No, it must have been my fault in the sense that I I surely didn't express myself as I wanted, but I thought I said at the end at the end of the talk that there are two models that aim at justifying the structure of proof previously that I previously referred to. This structure having this the presumption, the benefit of the doubt, the presumption of innocence, the burden of proof on the shoulders of the prosecution, and a high standard of proof. I think in the debate there are at least two models that try to justify that structure. One is the error distribution model, discussed for instance by Loudon and also by Richard Liebke, going against Loudon. But there is an alternative, at least a wave, nowadays a contemporary wave, to argue in favor of an alternative model that justifies the structure, this proof structure of criminal procedures. Which basically are worried that you don't convict the innocent, and basically they are saying that, put it in very rough terms, the costs of false acquittals shouldn't be factored in determining the standard of proof by which you decide that someone is guilty. And it is not the case that false acquittals are not important to the point of view of the institutional designer, for instance, or as we, as members of a society, it's not the case that we don't attribute costs to false convictions. But there are other ways, if you want more criminals to be in prison. You can do all other things that are epistemological, for instance, even epistemological, for instance, as also Jordi has put forward. You can enhance the reliability of the process itself. You can enhance, if you imagine these two curves representing the material innocent and the material guilty people, and this is the natural way in which people normally try to spell graphically the effects of moving or changing standards of proof. So in a way, the way you would make the curves of material innocent people and material guilty people that go to trial or undergo a criminal investigation to go this one to the left and this one to the right, separating the superposition, would be by making policies, epistemic policies, basically increasing the Keynesian weight of the evidence, what Dale Nance, for instance, calls the management of the Keynesian weight. The weightier bodies of evidence you manage and you create rules in order for us to have, the greater the likelihood that the verdict, that the decision is going to be accurate. And so you could do that. You could also invest money in having the equipment.
Why concern about not concerning with the cost of false acquittals? If you got more accuracy, you won't have any false acquittals, any false convictions.
And in that way, not having that problem would put an end to your worry that you are leaving guilty defendants off the hook. If you are getting at precise verdicts.
So your view is
no, no, no. It's not my view. It's just I'm trying to explain what would be the position of people endorsing this alternative model to justify the structure of criminal legal proof. What would be their position regarding false acquittals? It's not that you cannot attribute to them a cost, but it is only the contention that when it comes to establishing the degree of support, the standard of proof is supposed to establish as a threshold, you don't have to factor in the cost of false acquittals. Not denying that they have a cost, but the main worry, according to this model, that you should have and pursue when you are trying to put in place a standard of proof is that the state justifiably impose punishment upon people. And that's it. And just the last thing I wanted to add is that in this second alternative model, where you want to be accurate about, or more accurate, or mainly accurate about convictions, I think in this model, For this model, the worry that you expressed, that standards of proof may become political or a tool to manage expected utilities or other interests in policy, for instance, let people who think that they are wrongly accused to go free because of the social consequence that it would have. I mean, this model, I think, shields itself from those kinds of treatments, but I that precisely are affect the first model, I think.
That's then there are three models, right?
Or
the more extreme political, purely political consequences.
Yes. Yeah.
In the middle, we only concern about when we exercise the power to punish someone, we have to be justified. And the first would be the more reasonable, we should be concerned with applying the law, and that means convicting also people who committed crimes.
Yeah, but imagine that.
Not false acquittals, concern about the false acquittals, too, which was louder than first.
But one of the implications of that model is that nothing guarantees that the cost that you attribute to false acquittals in a certain period of time can increase so much that the level of the standard of proof falls deep down, even under the preponderance of the evidence threshold. I mean, there's no guarantee, because maybe it can express the objective, let's call it, costs attributable to false acquittals. Maybe, say, for instance, take the example of Loudon's methodology, not necessarily endorsing his methodology, but his so-called results, that recidivism regarding serious crimes grows exponentially, for instance, let's say. That would be a good reason to attribute more costs to false acquittals. But again, you don't have kind of a threshold or a limit. You can attribute, maybe out of a caprice or out of a more objective measures, more and more cost to false acquittals, that you can get to a point in which standard proof may be the preponderance of the evidence and even lower. And okay, if that happens, that wouldn't honor the.
But I think that if you do that, you are collapsing what I call the first model with the third one, because you are just concerned about the cost of each kind of decisions.
No, right? But you keep comparison.
If you keep the comparison. The first model, you are concerned with the truth and with convicting anyone who is guilty, and with not convicting anyone, all who are innocent. Mm. All innocents should be let free, and all the people should be convicted.
The one is the model you
it's
say
not
you endorse.
So the decision is about the commitment with the true and the correct application of the law.
And you endorse that model?
No, I think it's an analytical possibility.
Okay, but I would have thought that you were in favor of the error distribution model, because it incorporates the use of expected utility theory.
It's kind of problematic too, because you...
No, the problem that I am trying
no need to
convict
guilty people, no need to acquit innocent people, that depends. It's contingent what you should do. And this is problematic. The second is problematic because you are not concerned with what Lauda explained with wrongful acquittals, which might be very harmful in social terms.
Because
the problem seems to be, okay, you have to convict when you know that someone is guilty, and you have to acquit when you know that the person is innocent, and that's it.
Yeah, well, okay.
So, we have 5 minutes and 2 questions. Philip.
Just to better understand the safety condition, the question. So I have two questions. The first one is how this model will solve, maybe I lost your explanation, but will solve the case of the creationist teacher. Why I wonder how it will solve that case, because if the safety condition is conceived of as a standard proof, and that means that it is something that the speaker should try to comply with. So the speaker should assert only those propositions about which he is safe, or he thinks he's safe to assert. And what happens with people that have some conceptions of the world according to which there are close possible words in which the proposition is false, like conspiracy is.
Ah, that's a great question. Thank
maybe,
you.
Maybe that they will think that there is a close possible word in uh-huh. which, for example, Elon Musk altered the result of the U.S. election by raising millions of votes through his Starlink's disposition satellites or something like that.
Sí.
So there is a possible world in which the assertion Trump legitimately won the election is false. And that would be that
I thought you would say it's true. No, sorry.
But that's, and so it's not safe to, from a conspirationist point of view, it's not safe. Or am I understanding?
No, thank you. No, you're right. Thank you very much. The way in which maybe it's due to the my lack of clarity, but I think the way Preacher thinks the creationist and the racist trier of fact examples are, if not solved, I mean, the problem with them is that the justified belief and the knowledge condition accounts would render the verdict that asserting in such a case would be improper because you don't have a belief to start with. So if you don't have even a belief, you cannot have doxastic justification neither knowledge. That's kind of the and Preacher argues that being the case that safety, even factive, does not commit to or does not commit the asserter to believing the proposition asserted, at least it gives it aligns with our intuition that as long as there is good reliable evidence acknowledgeable by the assertors in such cases, even though they are reluctant to believe in the content of the proposition, they should selflessly, I mean, not involving their beliefs, assert maybe publicly or publicly that such and such is the case. So it's kind of the way in which Preacher treats those examples. And the other thing, I mean, I wanted to very quickly to refer to the dangers of, as you said, what about people who think conspirationists? And a good example here might be what is, according to certain people, happening in the criminal, in the international criminal law arena, basically in the international criminal court, in the case of Laurent Gbagbo, in the acquittal issued in the case of Laurent Gbagbo, where, according to Daryl Robinson, what happened there was that the judges were basically, regarding each piece of evidence, thinking of all these error possibilities for that not the defense thought they would think when deciding the case. So you can have too much of an apparently good thing, because in fact this behavior of the judges is described as an over-skepticism, or now moving to the to the side of being over-skeptic, because they were trying to send a political message, because the International Criminal Court in its first years of operation was very badly criticized that they were not doing their job. They were basically convicting any case regarding the feebleness or the weakness of the evidence. So in this case, certain commentary sees that the court is trying to give this political message, and that has become worryingly extremely reluctant and skeptical by concocting this or inventing these possible error possibilities and leading the way to the prosecutor to not be able to prove any future case. Well just
last question for Jaime.
Thank you, Edgar. My question is, what do you think about the the necessity to have a specific account of evidence compatible with some assumptions of some theories that you endorse in your talk.
That's good.
Because if you endorse a probabilistic account of evidence, where the evidence only writes the probability of true of an opposition, you never could rule out an alternative. Because rule out is a categorical term.
Well,
it's not come in degrees. So,
but you can say that the more error possibilities get excluded or at least addressed, the more probable or likely the truth of the proposition is. So
there is a principle of closure. Closure under conjunction. If I sum evidence and evidence and evidence, so if the probabilistic term, I need to have an a probabilistic account of that evidence too. So I sum up evidence and evidence, and the conjunction is always more low than the conjunction, the sum up of the conjunction.
Yeah, but don't thank you. Thank you. This is. There are surely out there different models or accounts of evidence circulating there. There, for instance, even in the evidentialist camp, you have different positions, I think, and different ways to sort out what it means for a certain body of evidence to support a proposition. There are explanationists out there. There are Bayesianists out there, and yes, I really do think to monitor whether or not I am not creating incompatibilities by way of endorsing on positions that shouldn't be mixture. I think that my account, in principle, is not Bayesian and wouldn't have to face those challenges. In principle, but thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.